The San Francisco Experience Podcast, brought to you by Jim Herlihy. Independent commentary from a Silicon Valley perspective for a global audience, featuring newsmakers, thought leaders, and authors. Season 26, Episode 8, Peak Economic Security in U.S.-China Relations, talking with Matt Furchen, Senior Fellow, Yale Law School. Hey, Matt.
Hi, Jim. Thanks for having me.
Our guest today is Matt Furchen, Senior Fellow and Senior Research Scholar at Yale Law School's Paul Tsai China Center. His research focuses on Chinese economic statecraft and economic influence. Previously, he was a faculty member in the Department of International Relations at Tsinghua University, Beijing. He was also head of Global China Research at the Mercator Institute for China Studies, Berlin. He joins us from his office in New Haven, Connecticut. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Jim.
Matt, please take a moment to tell us about your work at Yale Law School and also your time in China.
Thanks. My focus here is a continuation of longstanding interests in China's political economy, both its domestic political economy and its foreign economic policies and influence. And I'm really focusing these days on China's economic statecraft, the U.S.-China relationship, and in particular, the role that economic security plays in that relationship. And this builds on a long interest in China and the relationship between the state and the economy and how it governs the economy. And that sort of naturally evolved from a focus on a lot of domestic issues in China to one in which I began to look a lot more at China's relations with other regions, especially developing country relations. I did a lot of work when I was still in China on the China-Latin America, China-Venezuela relationship. And now that I'm in my position, which I began last year at Yale Law School's Paul Tsai China Center, I'm looking more specifically at elements of the U.S.-China relationship. And again, these issues of economic security now that are now at the forefront of that relationship.
Matt, why is the China Center in the law school rather than in the Department of International Relations, for instance?
It was created by a law school professor, and that's the main reason. So it was originally focused on primarily domestic Chinese legal issues, and we still have a number of scholars, my colleagues, who do focus on Chinese law. And that evolved over time to have more of a focus or to have an additional focus on U.S.-China relations. So some of my colleagues and myself do not have traditional legal scholar or law backgrounds. We look at broader issues in the U.S.-China relationship, and me in particular on some of these political economy dimensions. So we're an eclectic group, but still really with a basis in that original foundation when Paul Gwirtz created the center back in 1999, I believe.
Now, you yourself lived and worked in Beijing. You, of course, were a faculty member at the Tsinghua University in the Department of International Relations. Tell us about your experience living in China.
Yeah, I actually moved to China in 2000 as a graduate student, and I was still doing area studies and language work, and I lived there for 17 years. So I finished my PhD in 2008, and later that year after the Olympics, started teaching on the Faculty of International Relations Department at Tsinghua. And I was the only foreign faculty member during the time I was there. And so it was a real experiment at a very different time in China and in the U.S.-China relationship. I'm not sure that such a position would be available to someone like me today. So I really value having had the opportunity. I learned a lot. Wasn't always easy, but certainly I now more than ever value the ability to have had that opportunity and that kind of exchange to understand how people there are thinking about China and its role in the world.
And of course, you speak Mandarin.
Yes, I do. I did a lot of my initial PhD research in Chinese and continue to do a lot of my work, including on China's views on economic security in Chinese.
Very impressive. Matt, for almost 40 years, the cornerstone of U.S.-China relations was trade. The trade relationship peaked at about $750 billion of annual trade in 2023. But now, the economic security element of U.S.-China relations is increasingly in the forefront at the expense of trade flows. What happened?
It's a great question and something I'm still trying to puzzle through, but I think you see elements on both sides of the relationship. Many analysts point to China's change in its relationship with the United States and more generally with the global economy after the 2008-2009 financial crisis, a sense that China was no longer going to listen to the advice of Western economists and policy analysts to have the Chinese economy become more in line with Western standards. And then, of course, when Xi Jinping became the head of the party in 2012 and 2013, there was a real sense of a change in China's own domestic policies and foreign policies in a more statist and party-controlled direction. And then on the U.S. side, we see growing impatience with China's domestic policies, its industrial policies, its efforts to dominate certain areas of technology, more assertive foreign policies, including its Belt and Road Initiative, and a general sense that really came to a head during the Trump administration that the United States needed to push back, including on trade with tariffs in order to level the playing field. And I think we've just seen an evolution then into the Biden administration, including with very much of a focus on economic security issues, export controls, reviews of in Chinese and other investment, and generally seeing the economic relationship through the lens of economic security in a way that really didn't exist before. And I just, you know, add two things to this, which were sort of outside of the U.S.-China relationship. But one of them was the pandemic and real concerns about dependencies that were generated as a result of that, including for things like different sort of medical and pharmaceutical supplies. And then the Russian invasion of Ukraine and especially its use of gas flows to try to put mm-hmm. pressure on Ukraine and Europe. And both of those really added to the sense that economic issues could be a key component of power projection.
When we talk about, certainly for the last few years, two terms have come into common parlance when we talk about U.S.-China relations. One is decoupling, whereby the U.S. and China would decouple. The other is de-risking. Please define for us what decoupling means, what de-risking is, at number one. And number two, what is the United States? Is the United States decoupling? Are we de-risking? Please explain.
Yeah, I think the decoupling agenda is one of that really started during the Trump administration and was sort of symbolic of this idea that the U.S. needed to reassess the economic interdependence with China, in especially as this idea of a sort of pillar of the relationship and one in which the economic interdependence and trade relations was somehow thought of as somehow maybe in the future going to push China to become more liberal, both economically and politically. So this, I don't think there were ever clear definitions put on the idea of decoupling. And you saw, even in the Trump administration, certain officials moving away from that formulation again, but as a symbolic effort to try to say that the U.S. needed to be more aware of dependencies in the relationship and to try to move away strategically from some of those interdependencies and not to have these sort of rose-colored glasses about where the trade and broader economic relationship would lead. The de-risking concept, I think, as far as I understand it, really has come from a little bit of a pushback, including from European allies, of saying, let's not go so far in this idea of completely separating the U.S. and other economies from China, and let's think through what some of the risks are and manage those. Now, where the decoupling and the de-risking really are independent of each other is an open question. And I think from the Chinese point of view, they're basically the same thing. They think that this is all part of a similar strategy.
Of course, going back in history a little bit, 1972, President Nixon went to China on that very famous trip. The basis of U.S.-Chinese relationship is, I guess, still even today, the Shanghai Communique, where both sides agreed to certain elements of cooperation. They agreed to disagree on Taiwan, etc. And then fast forward to 1979, the United States recognized China. That was under President Carter. So that's a little bit of the history. Now, in the early, I think it was 2000, the PRC joined the World Trade Organization, WTO. Now, the WTO, of course, was an organization to foster international trade. It's a global organization. It was created at the Bretton Woods Conference in 1944. And essentially, China's phenomenal growth over the last 20 plus years as an exporting powerhouse has really been facilitated by the rules-based order of not only the World Trade Organization, but also the other elements of that Bretton Woods Treaty, which included setting up the IMF, the World Bank, the World Trade Organization, and essentially an agreement among the 44 countries that set it up to conduct themselves in terms of trade and international finances based on certain rules, based on the rule of law. But now it seems as though China, having benefited as they have, and their economic rise has benefited as a result of those rules that were created at Bretton Woods in 1944, they seem to be upending that. They seem to want to change. Why is that?
Well, I think if you look at the way that China approaches the WTO and many of its commitments, even in areas like intellectual property rights enforcement, market openness, that it has all along said these are sort of aspirations. And I think one of the things that really happened on the U.S. and European and many other countries who worry about China and the WTO and the broader global trading order is the sense of sort of frustration that over time, China really wasn't abiding by some of those fundamental commitments. Now, I think a lot of people would point to the way that the WTO actually functioned quite well in terms of adjudicating many of the disputes that came up and that China participated in those. But I think over time, there was really this sense of frustration that China was just operating in a fundamentally different way, and that the hope that it would sort of align more closely with these standards that were set at the WTO, with sort of international legal cooperation over trade and sort of rules-based trade, that there was a sense that China was increasingly operating on its own logic, including with industrial policy, that it was becoming more statist in the direction of the economy, that the party was playing a greater role. And this is especially under Xi Jinping's leadership. So I think a lot of the frustration that we see in the U.S. and elsewhere with China and the WTO and the rules as they exist has to do with this sense that China was really moving away from broader liberalization and adherence to many of these standards.
And of course, it's not only the WTO, where they seem to be somewhat skeptical and rejecting some of the norms of international trade and the rules-based order that we've operated under since 1944. Also, the supremacy of the dollar seems to be a a point of contention with them, and especially when they saw the United States and Western allies impose very comprehensive economic sanctions on Russia when they invaded the Ukraine, number one. And number two, as part of those economic sanctions, actually froze $600 billion worth of Russian deposits and foreign currency reserves held offshore. Would you say that that was a primary factor in China rejecting the primacy of the dollar and trying to replace it? And if so, what do they want to replace it with? And how does the United States respond?
Well, these concerns on China's part, but certainly not only on China's part, of the primacy of the dollar have been out there for a while. You know, the French for a long time have been concerned about the exorbitant privilege of the dollar. But and China has for a long time talked about trying to diminish the dominance of the dollar. Part of this is just sort of basic risk management, including when there's an international financial crisis, if there's more denominated in renminbi, that you sort of avoid some of that currency risk. So that existed before. But I completely agree with you that there is a real sensitivity. A lot of people in China paying great attention to the way that the U.S. has been using its dominance of the dollar and international currency flows in terms of some of these international disputes, in particular over Russia. So there's a lot of focus now on this idea of weaponization of interdependence, and I would say the U.S. ability to use the dollar in sanctions directed at Russia in particular, but certainly in many other disputes as well with Iran and others, is something that many in China are paying attention to and then search for some sort of alternative, more larger role for their own currency. But there are and have been limits on its ability to really make the renminbi more attractive internationally, and part of that has to do with capital controls and the way that the government restricts flows of currency and ability to even invest in the Chinese economy. So they've complained for a long time. They're worried about the U.S.'s ability to weaponize the dollar, but they also have relatively few channels for making some sort of a change and sort of increasing the power of their own currency.
During the APEC conference here in San Francisco last November, one of the stars of that conference was, of course, Xi Jinping himself. President Biden was here. Heads of state from around the Pacific were here. But Janet Yellen, Secretary of the Treasury, played a very, very prominent role in that conference. She continues to travel to Beijing with regularity, talking to her counterparts in Beijing about the U.S. relationship, the financial aspects of the U.S. relationship with China. While at the APEC conference here, she met with every single finance minister of all 23 or 24 APEC countries one-on-one, getting agreements with them on a myriad of subjects, going from cryptocurrencies to digital currencies to money laundering to a whole host of different subjects, but essentially getting those ministers of finance of all the APEC countries on side, if you will. But interestingly, when Xi Jinping's Air China 747 touched down at San Francisco International Airport, the first person waiting on the tarmac to greet him when he stepped off that plane and stepped foot on U.S. soil was Janet Yellen. How is that international financial relationship between the U.S. and China being managed? Because I've seen Jake Sullivan give statements about it and make a speech. And of course, as I said, we actually saw a very engaged and energetic Janet Yellen, Secretary of the Treasury, being involved in that too.
I think it's a delicate balance. I think there's still a sense that this financial relationship, the broader trade relationship, the economic relationship is still really important to both countries. Certainly, there's a lot of tough talk, including in relation to the need to more clearly think through dependencies, including in financial terms, and a sense that something needs to be recalibrated in the relationship. But you also have these sort of long-term differences in China as a country that ends up with very consistent surpluses that then get funneled through the U.S. financial system and the U.S. As a net debtor, and that sense that this is sort of a long-term relationship that is somehow dysfunctional and needs to be changed, but real difficulty in the way that both the U.S. and China approach their own domestic economic policies that make that difficult. So you're trying to manage that relationship given some of these fundamental macroeconomic disparities, and I think that's part of what we see. And Janet Yellen is clearly one of the people who's on the forefront of many of the criticisms of how China approaches its economic policies, and yet sees how fundamentally important that relationship is between the two countries and in managing more, you know, more broadly international economic relations.
Of course, high-tech chips. I'm sitting here in San Francisco. Just down the road from me is NVIDIA, Intel, AMD, all of which produce these very high-end, very sophisticated chips, which are being increasingly used both in the artificial intelligence area and also in, they have military applications, etc. The Biden administration, and particularly Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor, has coined this term of small yard, high fence in terms of putting restrictions around a small number of high-tech U.S. products that will be subject to very rigid, stern controls, including some of these chips that I just referenced. Give us the definition of what is the small yard and the high fence, and what's included in that small yard, essentially our tech crown jewels?
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think this is a struggle, though, of sort of how to define these things accurately, so such that the yard is truly small and the fence is truly high in terms of effectively protecting those areas that are seen as part of the, you know, real sensitive security issues. So, you know, among them, certainly semiconductors, others that Jake Sullivan has mentioned, medical equipment, AI technologies, quantum computing, synthetic biology, and then, of course, critical minerals. So the list, I think their efforts, including by Jake Sullivan and others that he works with at the NSC, and to try to really define what it is that's truly a security risk. You get these sort of dual use technologies that fit into what, you know, what is actually going to be restricted and worried about, including in terms of dependencies. And then there are things like critical minerals, where it gets to be a little bit trickier because it fades into or crosses over with other things that the U.S. and the Biden administration in particular see as important drivers of domestic growth in the U.S., particularly related to electric vehicles, and you see a lot of tension on that now. So I think there's a question of the logic of to what extent are these truly security issues and for whom, and to what extent are these really about drivers of jobs and growth in the U.S. in the long term. And this really gets us into some of the areas where people are questioning where economic security logic begins and ends.
Now, you referenced rare earths, and of course, those rare earths are used in these batteries for electric vehicles and for other tech batteries. Japan, for instance, until recently sourced 90% of their rare earths from China, but over the last couple of years, they've reduced that proportion coming from China from 90% to 60%. Is the U.S. in a position to do something similar? I mean, right next door in Canada, many of those rare earths are available in Canada. Are we actively following in the steps of what the Japanese have done to reduce their dependence from 90% to 60%? Are we doing something similar?
Well, there's many discussions happening along these lines, not just in the U.S., but certainly the U.S. and Japan are talking about this. The U.S. is talking with others as part of Mineral Security Cooperation Group, those in Indonesia talking about nickel. So it depends on the mineral that we're talking about, but there are many active efforts on the part of the U.S. to find ways of reducing these dependencies, both in terms of extraction of minerals and also processing. Europeans are talking about this. Others in Japan and other places in Asia are also discussing it. But sort of going back to that number, it's interesting when you hear discussions about Japan's efforts rethinking economic security and reducing some of these dependencies, this original dependence on China for rare earths of 90%, going down to 60% is thrown out there a lot. And I would just point out that it's still 60%, so yes. It's well over a half. So it's still, a large portion that Japan is sort of been willing to live with, even as it works to reduce that. But at the sort of the latest numbers I've heard, that's actually gone back up to 80%. So I think this just sort of shows that this is going to be really a long-term effort, and it's going to include a lot of costs. And those costs also include environmental costs, human costs, that China in many ways has borne over the years that it's developed its really dominant role in these critical minerals and rare earths that are feeding into so many of these technologies. So unless and until other countries are willing to bear some of those costs, I don't think we're going to see a lot of movement on sort of really reducing those dependencies. But these are very active discussions, both, sort of from a point of view of U.S. policy, but also in cooperation with other countries.
What is friendshoring? And how successful has the Biden administration been in friendshoring, I guess, in the wake of the rupture of some of the supply chains during COVID? How successful has the Biden administration been in friendshoring critical industries like the chip industry back to the United States or to India or to Vietnam? Is that really underway? What results are there to show for friendshoring? And please define friendshoring.
Yeah, I think, well, this fits into this broader discussion of reshoring and friendshoring. So should, for example, the United States try to bring far more critical minerals, mining and processing back to the United States itself? Or friendshoring would be, is it okay to cooperate with friends and allies, say Japan or Korea, on something like critical minerals or semiconductor chip production? So that's the idea, is a lot of this rethinking of supply chains and where dependencies could and should be reduced, often relative to China. So on the one hand, I'd say it's been successful in that there's a clear signal that the U.S. has sent that it wants to work with allies and partners to think through what these dependencies are, what to do about them. In terms of actual movement, I think it's been a bit hit and miss. So the U.S. has obviously put a lot of pressure on and worked with allies like the Netherlands and Japan on some of the semiconductor export restrictions. It's a lot of tension involved with that as well, but ultimately there's been cooperation. I think the jury is really still out on some of these critical minerals and the issues that I just mentioned in terms of these overall numbers and the sort of costs involved. So who is going to be among which friends are there going to be a sort of political and economic willingness to take on some of these supply chains? Some of these, people might want, including creating their own electrical vehicle industries, for example. But the U.S. also wants those. Mm-hmm. So there are some real barriers. And I think we're really just in the early stages of these discussions. And if we get a second Trump administration, I think that this will be a very difficult proposition, because I'm not sure that there'll even be an appetite in the U.S. then for working with friends and allies on some of these supply chain reforms.
Trade with China is a double-edged sword. Of course, that huge trading relationship, which last year peaked at $750 billion of bilateral trade between the two countries, actually gives us some leverage with China. And ditto, it also gives China some leverage with us. A good example is in the case of China and Russia. China's military aid to Russia during the Ukraine war, haven't they been very circumspect as regards not supplying military aid to Russia for fear of incurring the wrath of the United States and the Western powers, and perhaps becoming subject to to Western sanctions. The only point I want to make is that if we didn't have such a large trading relationship with China, China has skin in the game, basically. And so it gives us a certain amount of leverage to preclude China from maybe going whole hog in supporting Russia by selling them military equipment, etc. They appear not to be doing that to protect their Western trade links and to avoid economic sanctions from the West. Would you agree?
I think this is a real issue, as you know, for as important and realistic as I think it is for governments and businesses to be thinking about some of these dependencies in through the framework of economic security, sort of pick apart and reduce those interdependencies also potentially reduces U.S. leverage in areas where it wants to maintain it. So I think this is a really active discussion among those who are implementing some of the new sanctions and other export control sorts of policies, including in relation to Russia. Certainly some active discussions going on in terms of how the export restrictions on semiconductors are affecting China's ability to create its own semiconductor industry in ways that it may not have had an incentive to do in the past. Will that ultimately undermine U.S. efforts to protect its own security? So lots of active discussions related to this. And then, you know, others that are very much in a sort of related to geopolitical tensions in Asia, related to, say, Taiwan, and in the really important role that it plays in the global semiconductor industry and how important that role is. If you reduce it, then does that diminish?
Yes.
Its importance to China, and this sort of the interconnectedness and the sort of ways that that creates sort of disincentives for conflict, I think we disregard that at our own peril.
Well, Matt, in the remaining few minutes of the podcast, what are your closing thoughts? I mean, you've just illustrated to us how interconnected we are, and that interconnectedness gives us some leverage with China. China has leverage with us. We don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater if, you know, by picking apart this huge relationship, because China has skin in the game. They need to live and work with us, and we need to live and work with them so as not to jeopardize this huge trading relationship. What are your closing thoughts, Matt?
Well, the work that I'm doing now is looking at how a number of economies and countries in Asia are thinking about these issues of sort of the balance between interdependence, cooperation, prosperity, and security. Because I think we are at a moment when everyone, again, governments, businesses, societies, are trying to think through what a new, sustainable, viable balance can look like without blowing the whole thing up. So my current research is really looking at how countries who are the closest to China in its own neighborhood, who are the most interdependent with it, some of whom have come under pressure from China in political disputes where China has used economic coercion, its own version of sanctions against them, and thinking through how they are responding to sort of recalibrating interdependencies, working with each other, working with the U.S., but continuing to have a really important interdependent relationship with China. So I'm looking to see what kind of lessons can be learned from that and thinking what that especially means for recalibrating trade and investment cooperation, including international institutions.
Are there any other projects that you're currently working on, Matt, that you'd like to share with our listeners?
Well, the other one that I have going in the background is a sort of project related to China and the U.S. in this space of critical minerals, especially as it relates to Latin America, where I've had a longstanding interest. So in particular, looking at lithium and copper and ways in which some of those markets can be developed in a way that isn't framed as zero sum, that also provides development opportunities for those countries so that they aren't caught up in a sort of Cold War type two situation and their development opportunities are not harmed by some of this focus on economic security.
Mm-hmm. And Matt, how can our listeners follow you?
They can follow me through my own website, mattfurchin.com, through my Paul Tsai China Center at Yale Law School page, and also on Twitter.
And the spelling of your last name is F-E-R-C-H-E-N, and that's also the Matt Furchen, of course, is your website.
That's right.
Okay. And what is your X handle?
Oh, you know what? It's probably at Matt Furchen.
At Matt Furchen. Okay. Is there a handle for the Psi Center, or of course Yale Law School? We know what that is.
There also must be, because I haven't been there for even a full year yet, I actually don't know what that is. But there certainly is.
I'm sure that there is. Matt Furchen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
And for our listeners, today's podcast is number 515. Listen to us on Apple, Spotify, Pandora, 18 platforms, and join our listener base in 60 countries. FeedSpot has recognized us as a top 25 California news podcast, ranking number 12. This has been the San Francisco Experience Podcast with Jim Herlihy, coming to you from San Francisco.